Okay, why don't we get started? Can you hear me okay? Great. Hi, I'm Bill Dolan. I'm the manager of the MSR Natural Language Processing Group, and welcome to this session on conversational systems in the era of deep learning and big data. I'm just going to talk very quickly because we have a pretty full set of talks today with pretty tight scheduling. But we have a number of great speakers. The list is there. Alan Ritter from Ohio State, Michelle Galli and Lucy Van Der Wende, and Jason Williams from here in MSR, Jackie Chung from McGill, and Ian Lane from CMU. All will be giving their perspective on what's been happening in the area of dialogue, where in the last several years, the availability of massive data around dialogues, conversations that people are actually having with each other on social media, for example, along with better algorithms, neural algorithms in particular, have really upended the field of dialogue and opened up new possibilities in areas that had been pretty static for most of my career in natural language processing. It feels suddenly like things are moving very fast and moving toward a really useful future pretty soon. So without any further ado, I'm just going to hand things over to Alan, who is going to give the first talk. And we're the level that we've got.
Oh, I think I can just do that. Okay. Can everyone hear me okay? All right. Okay. Thanks, Bill. So just sort of following up just straight from what Bill was talking about, I'd like to sort of, step back a little bit and sort of give this kind of like flashback to like 2010 or so. So at this time, I think it's sort of fair to say that dialogue systems were mostly based on handwritten rules. There's some exceptions, these goal-directed dialogue systems have sort of, components that are based on machine learning. But at a high level, conversational agents are really sort of rule-based systems at this time, right? So around the same time, we were seeing a lot of progress in statistical machine translation. So machine translation algorithms were becoming really successful by taking advantage of the huge amounts of bilingual text that was available on the web and applying statistical methods to learn how to translate between languages, right? I was kind of just happened to be in the right place at the right time, working with Bill Dolan and Colin Sherry. And so we were sort of thinking, these days there's huge amounts of conversational data that's, easily available to get access to online. So if we just look at Twitter alone, people are having over 500 million conversations every month. This is sort of like an order of magnitude larger than available, parallel corpora that people are using for learning translation models. So, it's kind of a natural question of like, okay, can we apply some of these data-driven methods borrowed from statistical machine translation and apply them to learning conversational agents just directly from data? Okay, and so just a quick sort of side note, I'm also doing a lot of work on sort of extracting knowledge from big noisy text corpora as well. But I'll sort of focus mostly on dialogue here. I'll bring this up again at the end, maybe. So anyways, we kind of made this marriage between dialogue and MT, and there's been a lot of work along these lines since then. Okay, so it turns out this wasn't totally trivial to get working. So, if you think about like dialogue, it's actually very different from translation. So in translation, right, the source and target that we're trying to generate are semantically equivalent to each other, so it's a much more constrained space. Whereas in conversation, you can reply with almost anything to any input. Just to sort of illustrate that, one of the first problems we ran into is when we try to look at word alignment on these big conversational data sets, they totally break down because we have like these big chunks of phrases that we can't sort of decompose into any more fine-grained word alignments. We were able to get around this by taking advantage of these huge amount of data and using some tricks and things like that. Once we're able to do that and get some sort of large phrase tables extracted from this data, then we can sort of translate messages into responses using a process that looks something like this, where we have an input sentence, And you know, the first thing we're going to do is segment it into phrases. And then each phrase in the input is going to get translated into a phrase in the response. So for example, here, you know, dinner might get translated as yum. You know, who wants to might translate as want to. Come over translates as be there. And you know, tomorrow is translating as tomorrow. And so each of these phrase pairs are being mined from these really big conversational corpora. And then you know, we're just picking pairs that have like sort of like a high translation score, and also have you know, generating a response that has like a high score according to a language model. So this is this sort of noisy channel model for translation. Okay, so this worked, and there was people were sort of I think it was pretty interesting. But around 2014 or so, there was something interesting that happened that. Neural networks basically totally took over in machine translation, and sort of soon after that, people started applying these neural network models for dialogue as well. You know, basically applying the same ideas. And so here I'm just showing a sample of some of the work on this. But there was kind of like a key problem that like many of the neural network translation models have that were reported independently by multiple different research groups, which is that they tend to generate really boring and safe responses. So they're not adding any sort of new content to the conversation. And I think this actually makes a lot of sense if you think about what they're doing. So these neural translation models are trying to basically just generate a response that has the highest possible probability conditioned on some conversational context. But this isn't necessarily like the best way to have a conversation, right? It's to say like the most expected, the most probable thing in response to an input. So there's some replies that are just sort of like a good reply in almost any context. So almost anything you say to me, I can say I don't know in response, but that's not necessarily like a good conversation, right? Okay, so this led us to think about, okay, so how can we design different objective functions rather than just trying to maximize the likelihood? And so we're sort of thinking about, like, okay, how can we design models that maximize some measure of expected reward over the entire sort of future of the conversation? You know, that sort of naturally leads to this idea of reinforcement learning. Okay, so I just want to credit Jiwei Li, who's a PhD student at Stanford, who's really the person that's been like driving this work forward. Okay, so just to kind of illustrate this, let's say we have two conversational agents talking to each other. So we might give to one of these neural conversation models an input that looks something like this, like, how old are you? And the model replies, I'm 16, so this looks okay, right? And then the response to that is going to be 16 question mark. And so at this point, the model kind of breaks down and says, I don't know what you're talking about. And then the response to that is, you don't know what you're saying. And now we're stuck in this like infinite loop, right? Okay, so what went wrong here? So if we look back, maybe we can say this answer, although it's informative, is not really a good action to take, because it sort of doesn't leave any place for the conversation to go. Like, it's not adding any new content, but we don't really find out that this is a bad action until several steps later in the conversation, right? So this sort of naturally looks like a reinforcement learning problem. Like, we want to pick, actions that lead to, good sequences of conversation. Okay, so just to sort of formalize this a little bit, how do we sort of formalize this problem as a Markov decision process we can solve using reinforcement learning? So the state space is basically we're going to have a recurrent neural network encoder that's going to read in the input sentence and represent it as a fixed size vector representation, and then conditioned on that, we're going to take an action which is just going to be a sentence that's generated by a recurrent neural network language model, right? So of course, there's been a lot of previous work on reinforcement learning for dialogue. Really, the difference here is we have, an infinite action space, so you can, respond with any sentence, and the state space is also infinite. Okay, so to train these models, we basically just do this sort of simulation process where we take a message from our training set and have the model just talk to itself. to generate a conversation, and we just sort of repeatedly sample conversations from the data. So basically, you know, given one of these automatically generated conversations, we're then going to design some reward functions that we can automatically compute, right? Without going, you know, too much into the details of the reward function, basically the objective function we want to maximize is just the expected reward over the whole conversation, and then we're just going to use these policy gradient methods to tune the parameters of the encoder-decoder response generation model to learn a policy that maximizes expected reward, right? So these policy gradient methods kind of make more sense than like Q learning, for example, in our case, because we can initialize the policy with the maximum likelihood parameters. All right, so I kind of like waved my hands a bit about how we define the reward signal. You know, we came up initially with some sort of heuristics about how to do this. You know, sort of another idea is, you know, maybe we can design a reward that's based on the idea of the Turing test, which is that, you know, basically if we have, you know, a person that's talking to, you know, a computer or like another person, if we can sort of generate a chatbot that can sort of talk to this person and fool them into thinking that they're, you know, talking to a person, then, you know, that should be like what we want to do, right? So this sort of naturally leads to this idea of adversarial learning, which first came up in computer vision. So I'll just sort of go over how that works in the context of dialogue. So basically what we're going to do is to have a bunch of real-world conversations that we're going to, you know, just sample conversations from this data set and then automatically generate responses to the user's input. Separately, we're going to have this discriminator model that's basically just going to try to predict, is this a real conversation, or a real response, or a response that was generated by our model? If the discriminator is fooled, we can sort of treat that as like a reward signal. So the model is basically being trained to try and fool the discriminator. And we just sort of alternate between training our generative response model and the discriminator, and try to generate better responses that look more like human responses, right? And so again, we're just going to train this using these policy gradient methods. So this actually leads to this adversarial learning actually leads to better responses. So we, you know, compared it against the sort of heuristics that I sort of skipped over by basically just showing, you know, generating conversations and then showing evaluators on Mechanical Turk, conversations that are generated using by both the models, and the adversarial model wins most of the time. Okay, so just to kind of wrap up a little bit, so just thinking a little bit about some future directions. So another sort of topic that I'm you know really interested in is this sort of problem of knowledge-based population and how can we sort of build information extraction systems that can sort of read in all the real-time text people are writing on social media and in the news every day, and sort of maintain these knowledge bases that are kind of constantly updated with like the current state of the world. I think there's some really interesting questions about how do we integrate, you know, knowledge into these conversational agents so that they can have sort of like, you know, more meaningful, you know, conversations based on, information that's contained in knowledge bases. So I think this is one, you know, really, really kind of promising direction for future work. So just to wrap up, a couple takeaways. So I talked about this data-driven approach to dialogue, where we're trying to have, you know, open domain conversations on any topics, learned from, large amounts of conversational data that are sort of freely available on the web. That tends to lead to relatively boring sort of contentless conversations just by itself. So I talked about like one possible way to address this, which is, learning from delayed reward and trying to have conversations that maximize some measure of expected reward over the sort of entire, future of the conversation. And then finally, I briefly mentioned this approach to adversarial learning, sort of based on the idea of the Turing test. Thanks.
questions. I wonder if you might comment a little bit more on the difference that I remember being struck by between the older statistical machine translation models, mm-hmm. where the mappings that were emerging from the parallel data were actually very contentful and very interesting. And then as we moved away from those models to neural, yeah. the opposite became clear. Suddenly the responses were very fluent and they were very, very boring. And it's interesting. I don't know if you have thoughts on how to begin to pull those two together.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. So, yeah, I think this issue of the really boring responses and always saying, I don't know, didn't come out as much in the sort of traditional statistical phrase-based translation methods. I feel like at the same time, they often generate, they didn't sort of, like the neural models tend to be like sort of more often generate something that seems like reasonable, like plausible in the context. So I feel like maybe they're somehow, you know, maybe the statistical MT models you can think of as sort of not totally optimizing the objective as well as like, you know, maybe one way to think about it. So they're sort of, you know, they're sort of injecting a little bit more sort of randomness into how they respond.
Yeah, which feels more human in some sense than the very, very fluent but not interesting contributions that the neural models tend to make.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's really promising about the neural models is because they're sort of end-to-end trainable, you could think about like incorporating all kinds of additional context into the conversation. So in that way, I think there maybe seem like a more promising direction for going in the right. future, you know.
Other questions? Do you want to set up? Oh, sorry.
Is there a concept...
Yeah, it's good.
Is there a concept of like personal identity, facts about an actual persona that goes into the conversation system?
Yeah, I think there's been some work along those lines. Not that I've done personally, but I think also at MSR by also you guys were collaborating with Jiwei, I think, on that, right? So yeah, maybe you'll hear about that in just a second.
Okay, thank you.
Cool. Let me move this.
And next up, splitting the slot, are Michel Galli and Lucy van der Wende here.
Can you hear me? Yes? Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Michel Galli, and today I'm going to be talking about work we did recently at MSR on neural conversation model, and more particularly how to tie them to the real world. So that's what we mean by ground and neural conversation models. And Lucy van der Wende is going to give the second half of his talk. So, and before I get started, I want to acknowledge the many great interns we've had over the years. And as pictured on the top, we had interns back working on conversational intelligence going back to 2010, actually, Alan. And then many other people came, and at the bottom, while this is me and Lucy giving the talk, this is actually work of an entire team of researchers. Most of these people are in the MSR AI NLP group. Okay, so what's the goal here? And that kind of relates to what Alan was studying in his previous talk, is what our goal here is to learn to converse from lots, big amounts of training data, and we want, so some of the goals are, we want the conversation to be seamless and natural, to be totally open domain, so that we're able to talk about many different topics, for example, in this example, talking about the weather, and then switching on to maybe giving some travel recommendation, and also be of different genres, going from chit-chat, and hopefully, and that's actually one of the main points of this talk, is to move to some a bit towards dialogues that are not just about chit-chat, but maybe more informational, or maybe slightly more task-oriented. Okay, and as Alan pointed out, there's been a lot of work in that space, starting from 2011, and then first using machine translation approaches, and then moving on with neural approaches. And as Alan was pointing out, there are many challenges with this approach, things that make kind of the differences between translation and conversation models and things like the blandness issue and so on. And there are many different issues. I mean, here the model, for example, that makes the models pretty hard to train, because oftentimes, while in machine translation you want to, you have a simple mapping between the source and target, in conversation you often want to enrich the input with a lot of conversation contextual information, know whatever was said before in the conversation and incorporate more information into that. So anyway, we've been able to train pretty big conversation models up to 140 million conversations, and that's maybe one of the downsides of these models. Like, you need a lot of data to kind of avoid this blandness issue, and even with that amount of data, you still have issue which you can deal with things like reinforcement learning. But now I would like to, I mean, that's the point of this talk. I want to see kind of a different perspective here between this line of work with a conversation model and works that I've done in dialogue earlier on. So of course, dialogue system have been around for a very long time, and the more kind of traditional way of building a dialogue system is one where you have more of an explicit understanding component and more explicit generation component, and there's also that enables a tie with the environment, so that if you have some kind of more structured representation of the input or output, then that enables to query, for example, a database and knowing what's going on. Whereas with a neural model that Alan and I are talking about, it's kind of moving away from this, where we don't have these different boxes. It's less of a pipeline. You have one integrated model that can be learned really end-to-end with one big box. But what we're losing in the process is that while you can easily ground the standard, more traditional way of building a dialogue system, here we kind of lose the grounding. So I have two disadvantages with this kind of lack of grounding. I mean, the first one is, of course, you don't have this tie of, you know, if you cannot query, like, let's say, your calendar and things so on. But the other downside is, like, models, like what we train, neural models, tend to be outdated pretty quickly. So if you ask a question, who's the president of France? And if you train this model, let's say, 3 months ago, then you'll not get the correct answer. So it's kind of, these models are really hard to train, and then just they get outdated pretty fast. So our goal recently in our group has been to kind of exploit and try to get the best of both worlds and do data-driven conversation, but in a more grounded way. And the first step of doing that is one where, let's say, you start with a pipeline that is a bit like a standard sequence-to-sequence model. So you want to model the fact that you go from an input that is going to Kusakabe tonight, which happened to be some Japanese restaurant, and then it's the kind of scenario where you want some kind of grounding. You want to have some tie to an external knowledge base that tells you maybe what Kusakabe is. So the way you approach this problem is we're actually not going to hand code anything here. We want to explore two sorts of knowledge. One that is conversational. You have the input. So at the top, you have conversation history that kind of condition that actually represent your dialogue history, but also you're going to infuse some facts that are relevant to the context. So for example, here, in this kind of experiment we've been running, we used Foursquare data, where any kind of facts that are relevant to the conversation are added to the context of a conversation. So the motivation here is also that, I mean, beyond enabling this grounding, it's also a natural way of infusing non-conversational knowledge into the system. So most of the external knowledge that we have is actually not encoded, I mean, it's not represented directly in the training data. A lot of it is for external, some things you might find, for example, in Wikipedia or Foursquare. So the idea here is that there are a lot of patterns in, like, say, Twitter or Reddit, where you see this pattern, like, you know any good A restaurant in B and so on, but it's not instantiated for a particular instance that you care about. So you have this external source, like could be, in our case, it was Foursquare, it could be like Wikipedia. And in a way, you're learning the structure of the conversational patterns from the Twitter data, while you can almost in a way like do some kind of implicit slot filling through non-conversational data. And so here are some examples of our system that is knowledge grounded. So I mean, you can see some. What's interesting is like it enables this blending of these two sources of information. So the input is I'm going to LAX, and the response is nice airport terminal. Have a safe flight. So have a safe flight is more like representative of what you might learn from Twitter, because you have this stimulus response pattern like. Going to the airport, have a safe flight, but also it says something more specific about that terminal. And it also sometimes, I mean, analyzing what sometimes things go wrong here. So one of the responses is the best J.Crew in the world, try the lemonade. I mean, so sometimes it does this blending, but perhaps not in a very good way, and sometimes mixing different reviews from different people. So I think it's now it's able to do this blending of different sources of information provided both grounded and grounded, but there's more work to be done in terms of finding perhaps some kind of contradiction. So anyway, so this work is work on data-driven conversation, fully data-driven conversation, and we try to move to something that is more useful. So if you could see this on some kind of continuum between doing something that pure chit-chat that characterizes much of earlier work in this neural conversation model, and on the other hand, doing something that is more task completion. So on one end of the spectrum, you have more like traditional, popular dialogue system that are grounded. And the other end of the spectrum, you have fully data-driven ones that are actually not grounded. So this work is actually one step toward doing something that is still fully data-driven, but towards doing something a bit more useful than just chit-chat. Okay, so and there have been other work on grounded, on grounding and fully data-driven models that have been exploring at MSR. So I mean, we've been doing a lot of work on personalization. So if can you infuse knowledge about a particular user into the conversation? Maybe things that have been said to that person or by that person. And we've been also doing work on exploiting other things like GPS and visual signal. And this is where I'm handing this over to Lucy, who has been doing work in that space.
I'm on, but they haven't switched me. Yeah, OK. So just to pop back up, so what Michelle and Alan have just been presenting to you is data-driven conversation. So if you input is my son is ahead, and boy, is he surprised. And then, you know, kind of the model might say he should be proud of himself. It's a fairly reflexive reaction. Now, in parallel, I have been working on a different type of grounding, which you may have seen me present last year at the faculty summit, where given an image, the task that we had formulated was to generate a natural sounding question that a person would like to answer. So these were not questions meant to be answered by a computer vision system. These were meant to be interesting and engaging questions that a person would like to answer. And we presented that work in 2016. Again, it's a slightly overlapping set of authors, and Nasrin Mostafazadeh from University of Rochester and Ishan Misra from CMU were the lead authors on that. So it makes sense to try to put these two together. So that's what we are now calling image-grounded conversation. So given a textual tweet, if you were, plus an image that's included in the tweet, think of that together, what would you ask when you receive that image and text, and what might you respond? And this is work that we've described in the Image Grounded Conversations paper that is currently up on archive, and it's being submitted to a major conference. And I just want to point out, this is a very common thing. So Mary Morris Ringel in 2015 estimates that about 27% of all tweets are accompanied by some type of image, and that was rapidly increasing. So there are a lot of tweets that are, you know, kind of include images. So it's a very natural task. And so, in fact, that leads us to one of the data sets that we collected. So from Twitter, we collected, in this case, just sampled a set of 250,000 conversations that are photo and tweet, followed by a question, followed by a response. And that's our data set, and because that's the type of conversation that we want to learn how to produce. At the same time, we also generated a data set using the crowd for the following reasons. One is, from our question generation data set, we had eventful images. So we presented a selection of these images and asked the first crowd worker to select an image and make a comment about it, as one would do here. So the question here was, I checked out the protest yesterday. We then brought in a second person into the conversation who was constrained to ask a question about this tweet plus image. And they said, do you think America can overcome its racial divide? And then we put it back to the first person to respond, etc. Creating this crowd data set gives us the ability to source 5 additional questions, because this one question is not the only possible question that could have been asked, and to source multiple responses as well. Again, because given the background and you could have multiple responses. So we further collected multiple turns so that we, in the future, can study longer conversations. Now, the key characteristics of this data set are that these are natural-sounding conversations about a shared image, so they're grounded in the image. The conversation topics are about events and actions that are evoked by the objects in the image. They're not about the image themselves. They're about what is depicted by the image. I did an analysis to confirm that both the image and the textual context are informative for the question generation. I did that by doing a FrameNet analysis of this dialogue, confirming that, as here, this example, the question, where is that from, is related in this case to the frame that is evoked by the textual context. Look at what food I ordered. Another possible question could have been, are there nuts in that? That would have been evoked by the food framework from the image directly. So we see a good mix of some questions are evoked by the image frame and some are evoked by the textual frame. So that gives us a confidence that this is a good data set where both vision and text are important. The following conversation, the other characteristic that I'm particularly looking for is that there is a complex temporal and causal relations that are observed across multiple turns in the conversation, just as you would expect. So I see a lot of different types of relations that hold across multiple turns. So these are not simply question-answer pairs that are linked together. It is a continued and a consistent conversation and a change of topics across the conversation. So that is, I think, the dialogue that we really aspire to. And I'll just stop here. I have some examples. So in this case, the models that Michelle just explained to you generate who's winning and what happened for these images. And in the interest of time, we thank you.
But if anybody has a quick question for either Michelle or Lucy? No? Okay, maybe you can catch them in the hallway if you do. Next up is Jason Williams, also from MSR.
Okay, can everyone hear me all right? Is this on? Okay, I see some thumbs up. Great. So I'm going to talk about the other end of the spectrum, building task-oriented dialogue systems using an end-to-end framework called hybrid code networks. So I'll first introduce hybrid code networks. These are an LSTM, or some kind of recurrent neural network, that take all of the observable dialogue history as input, and as output give a distribution over actions to take. And here, I'll use actions as templates. So I won't be generating arbitrary text. This will simplify the problem. To get started in building a task-oriented system, typically there are no dialogues in the domain of interest. There is not a training set to draw on. So to bootstrap this process, I'll ask the developer to provide a handful of examples of the kinds of dialogues that they want to imitate. And I'll show an example, a demo of this in a minute. These can either be a small corpus, or you can train the system interactively. Then once the system is up and running to some reasonable extent, you can deploy it to a friendly set of users, collect some dialogues, and then look at transcripts and make corrections. Those augment the training set grows. And once the system is up and running at a sort of a good enough level of performance with a high enough volume, you can switch on reinforcement learning. And at the end, I'll show some quick results for how that can be done. This approach, and I'll, the next slide will go into this in more detail, is fully situated in code. So I can express domain knowledge in the form of code. Concretely, that means I can give business rules that constrain which actions are available. This is important because if you're building, for example, a banking system, you want to be able to code relationships like the person must be logged in before they're allowed to transfer funds. That's not a relationship you want to learn. You want to code for that and be able to test it. That has a serendipitous side effect that also will reduce the complexity of the learning problem. Actions can also refer to API calls. And so API calls here are first-class citizens, or communicative actions and API actions. So let me quickly show you what a loop of this looks like, and then I'll give you a quick demo. So on the left here is a chat interface, and the person types in, what's the weather this week in Seattle? So that's going to get presented to the RNN in a couple of different ways, featureized in a couple of ways. There's a bag of words vector, utterance embedding vector. This will allow us to capture both proprietary terms and also synonymy out of the box. This is a pre-trained embedding model. To extract entities, there's a separate entity extraction model. In the demo here, I'm going to use Lewis, which is a Microsoft cognitive service. That process, entity extraction, produces mentions, so text mentions that have a type. That gets passed a code that the developer provides. That lets them resolve those entity mentions to entities in their domain. That then outputs context features, for example, which entities are now in context in this dialogue, so which entities have I recognized so far, and also an action mask, and that's where the developer can express this domain, these domain constraints over which actions are available or not. The RNN produces a distribution over the action templates that the system knows how to take, and then the action mask gets element-wise multiplied with that to force certain actions to zero. So this mask is your opportunity to clamp certain actions to zero. Then choose what action to take. If this is supervised learning, then that means take the max. If it's reinforcement learning, you sample from this. You then do entity substitution. So in this example, that city mention, you would take the value of city and substitute it back in. Then depending on the action type, if it's an API call, you would execute that API call. That could be an actuator that presents rich content or makes the robot produce a particular gesture. It can also be a sensor that returns some API result. So it's a feature that can be passed back to the RNN. And then if it's a textual action, you render that to the user. And then this is a stateful model, so you pass back in the action that was just taken. So this is the action. This is the operational loop for hybrid code networks, and that's what's driving what I'm going to show you in just a second. So in this interactive demonstration, this is in the weather domain. And I've provided code that connects to the Weather Underground API to look up weather forecasts. And I've seeded this with three entities, cities, dates, and forecasts, and three actions, which city, which day, and play a forecast. I've also added three relationships here. So ask, don't ask, so only ask the city and day if you don't already know it, so common sense, and don't play the forecast if you're unable to. So this is common sense, but in a, this could be a more complicated relationship in a, say, in a banking system or so on. Okay, so now I'm going to do a demo. Actually, if I sit down, can people even see me down here? Okay, I'll sit down so I can type. Oh, yeah. Is it the perfect wrong height? Okay, so I'm going to be typing into Skype over here. I haven't figured out how to make the text in Skype any bigger. So I'm sorry for that. So on the left, I will start by saying, what's the weather in Seattle? So that's the user typing something in. Now what comes back is for me, the developer, as the teacher. And you can see it's recognized that Seattle is a city. And now there's a distribution over the three actions that knows how to take. The first one is has all the probability mass because of the rules that I've expressed. So there's really no machine learning yet that's interesting. As the teacher, I'll say, yes, I want you to take action number one. So ask for which day. The system will then come back and take that action. And now as the user, I'll say today. So that's the user's input. The system will come back and say, OK, I recognize today as a date. And now I'll play the, I want to play the weather forecast next. So great, go ahead and do that. This is now the weather forecast for Seattle for today. And now let's say the user might say, thanks. Well, now none of these actions are appropriate actions at this point. This is the, and users do this. Real users will come along with things you didn't expect. So what I can do is I can type in a new action. This is me saying, OK, system, I want you to take that action in this situation. And what happens at this point is this action gets added to the catalog of actions. The model gets retrained, given the dialogue so far. And the dialogue is now replayed through the LSTM up to this point. And that's now what this model would do at this point if that were the preceding training dialogue. Then I could continue along. Instead, I'm going to go on to the next conversation. So now this is imagine that person number two comes up and uses the system. And they might say, what's the weather in San Francisco today? So in this example, I'm providing multiple entities. That's OK. And now you can see that action, no problem that I added, that doesn't have any constraints associated with it. So now the machine learning process really is being asked to do something. It wants to play the forecast. Great, go ahead and do that. Now maybe the person might say, what's, let's say, how about tomorrow? Can recognize tomorrow as a day, as a date. And it wants to play the forecast. That's great. And I think before I typed in thanks, so I'll say, oops, I'll say thank you, which is lexically different, but because there's a word embedding model that's pre-trained, there's a concept of synonymy, so I have a chance of getting this right, and I do. So the system comes back and says, no problem. So far, so good. So now this is the sort of the interactive teaching approach, and you can imagine building this up and entering in more. But let me switch over now, and I'll turn that teaching mode off, and I'll start a new conversation and show you what it would look like for an end user that comes along. And rather than show you things working more, I'm gonna continue to break it. So I'll say find restaurants. So there is no, this system has no capacity to help with this, obviously. It says which day. I won't belabor this. I'll just go on to the next conversation. Maybe someone else comes along and says, search for toy stores. And again, there's nothing that can help with this. Now, this is what happens when you launch a system. You know, people come along with unexpected things. And that's OK. That's not broken. That's a normal part of system development. So what happens on the right-hand side here is these are the logged conversations. This is now what the developer can see for what occurred. So if I look at this conversation, oh, here the system said which day. That's not right. And in fact, none of these are right. I want to add a new action. So I'm going to type in, sorry, I can't help with that. This will do that same process. It will add this action, rebuild the model, and then redeploy the model so it's available. And if I look at this action or this dialogue here, sorry, I can't help with that. That's right. So I'll go ahead and submit that. And then just to close the loop, once that has deployed, I can pick this up in here, and we'll see if I get it right. So let's see. I had search for toys to find. Let's say look for barbershop. So lexically different, but semantically kind of similar. Sorry, I can't help with that. How about what's the weather in Dallas? And which day? Oh, today. And we can still play weather forecasts. So you can see how you can go back and forth between doing interactive teaching. You can look at log dialogues. So that's sort of anecdotal and interactional. I'll just briefly gloss some quantitative results. I think I have just maybe 2 minutes left. So this is a data set released by Facebook. It's called the Baby Dialogue data set. It's derived from the second dialogue state tracking challenge data. The task 5, the column on the left, is simulated data. The task 6 on the right is human-computer data that's been sort of post-processed. So on the left, if task 5 is simulated, if you know the rules, then it's possible to... So the task here is they give you example dialogues in a training set. You have to try to predict what next system action the system should take in a test set. So on the left, if you know the rules, then you can get to 100%. These are past papers that have proposed various neural network architectures for end-to-end learning. And on the right, the rules do much less well, and the learned methods do quite a bit better. The past methods use very little domain knowledge. They're really learning everything end-to-end. This approach I've described does support the integration of domain knowledge, so I've done that. So there's more intelligence that's in here. I've injected some intelligence in here. So if you're willing to do that, the benefit then is that you can completely recover the behavior of this rule-based simulation, and then you can also do better than past work on learning in the real human-computer setting, which is very noisy. And just one last slide, just to gloss some reinforcement learning results. This is a different setting. Again, this is in name dialing. This black line is if you do sort of standard reinforcement learning. This is in simulation. And then the colored lines, a nice property of this model is that reinforcement learning and supervised learning, you're optimizing the same model. You're just changing the loss function. And the colored lines here show if you add increasing numbers of pre-training supervised learning dialogues, so just example successful trajectories. And this gives you a big lift in where you start, and you get to an optimal level of performance quite a bit faster. So just to briefly conclude, this is looking at that other end of the spectrum, how to build task-oriented systems in an end-to-end, using an end-to-end approach. This is for a particular domain. Hybrid code networks combine an LSTM with code. You can express the domain knowledge in code the things that are easy to learn, the things that it makes sense to learn. You can use this interactively by providing a corpus of labeled examples or with reinforcement learning. I think the quantitative results look pretty strong, and it's useful for building real systems, real practical systems. So I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Okay, questions? Oh, we have one here.
For a reinforcement learning system, what is the reward function?
Yeah, so the reward function is you get +1 if you successfully transfer the user to the person they're trying to call. And everything else, every intermediary action gets 0. And if you transfer the person to the wrong place, then you get -1. And the user will, this does not get to 100% by construction. The simulated user will randomly give up at some point. They'll get frustrated if things go on too long. Also, sometimes they will want to call someone who's not in the directory by construction, by design. They'll also not, you know, answer the question that they're asked directly all the time. It's a very simple reward function, and it's all delayed. There's no shaping. There's nothing to help the system to find the right path until they've discovered a successful path.
Okay, thanks, Jason.
Sure.
Next up is Jackie Cheung from McGill.
Okay, great. Can you all hear me? Okay, great. So I'll be talking about moving towards world-level understanding for conversational agents. So as you probably don't need convincing of, conversational agents have many possible uses, from, say, technical troubleshooting to medical diagnoses to maybe shopping or marketing applications or general chit-chat. So we've seen a wide range of these types of systems mentioned in some of the previous talks. So, but a corollary of this is that because they have so many possible application settings, there's probably very little data for your particular domain or application of interest. So that's going to be one theme of my talk. And that relates to some of the goals that I think that dialogue agents must exhibit. So here are two of them. It's not exhaustive. So I think that dialogue agents must be robust and useful. So they have to be robust in the sense that you should not need that much additional training data or additional engineering, if possible, for every word or entity or domain or genre or task that you want to develop an agent for. And on the other hand, you also want your agent to be useful in the sense that they should be able to understand and correctly process various events, entities, and relations, beliefs, intentions, desires, and sentiment, emotions, and attitudes, and so forth. So whether or not you need to explicitly represent these in your model, all of these things in your model, that's more up for debate. But at the very least, they should be able to handle and process them. So one question to ask is, so these days our LSTM models are very standard in NLP, and everyone loves them. So one question to ask is, if you just train them in a very standard vanilla way, how much do they satisfy these particular goals and desiderata? So as a case study, one of my former undergrads, Michael Noseworthy, and also in collaboration with Joel Pinot from McGill University, we looked at whether we can predict dialogue success in human-human dialogues. So this is work that's going to appear in SigDial this year. So first, we created a data set from stackoverflow.com for with the goal of predicting the success in these conversations. So since this is a technical domain, you have questions like, let's see. So say user A asks some technical question about stack trace window being closed and how do you redisplay it. And a second user gives an answer. And then user A says, thanks, I don't know how I overlooked it. So this is an example of a successful dialogue, a successful conversation. So we came up with a model based on the LSTM architecture. And in fact, we adapted that model a bit so that it better represents the turn-based nature of these dialogues. And we trained it in a standard supervised setup. So first of all, we get fairly good performance results. So in terms of recognizing successes versus failures, if you look at the success cases, you get an F1 of, say, 89 if you train on the full conversation thread, and 73 on the failure case. But we were also interested in understanding why these models are able to achieve this performance. So we ran a kind of ablation study where we took away some of the data and see how much the performance drops. So if you look only at the last comment in the thread, you actually get just a small drop in performance. Whereas you train on everything except for the last comment, you get a much more substantial drop in performance, especially on the failure cases. So these results suggest that the LSTM model is picking up mostly on discourse cues. So for example, a very strong cue is whether or not the user at the end expresses gratitude. So you can see that in this previous case. Just by seeing that the last comment is, thanks, I don't know how I overlooked it, you can already tell that it's a success. And that's not really surprising, I guess, right? So the LSTM model, it's trained to really optimize for what you tell it to optimize. And for this particular task, that's the most useful cue, and that's what it makes the most use of. What's much harder is to be able to develop this understanding of whether the original information need was really satisfied by looking at the semantics of the question and the semantics of the answer and seeing whether they match in some way. So that's what arguably we need to do if we want to have these individual components be more widely useful and reusable. So the angle that my team has been tackling this problem from is to look at incorporating more world knowledge into these conversational agents and other NLP applications. So ideally, we'd like to incorporate additional information, such as, say, Wikipedia pages, or WordNet, or a knowledge base and the structure of knowledge bases, or specialized dictionaries. Or if you're working in a specialized domain, maybe you're running some website focusing on TV shows, so you have TV show descriptions. Or you're selling some products with your side hustle startup company, and you have product descriptions. So we'd like to be able to leverage these in order to better train our models, and potentially to generalize better and develop more robust systems as well towards these new entities and events and tasks. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about some newer work that has been done by my recently graduated master's student, Teng Long, also in collaboration with Emmanuel Benjo, Ryan Lowe, and Doina Prickup. That's going to appear at EMNLP. So we thought about the problem of trying to model rare entities, rare named entities in text. So what we did was, first of all, we decided to collect a data set. Or actually, we offloaded this work to previous work. So there's already this Wikilinks corpus developed by Seng et al. In 2012, which was originally used for coreference resolution. So the property of this corpus, which makes it interesting, is that it's a web corpus where there are spans annotated with links to Wikipedia pages. So what we did was we enhanced that data set by also extracting definitions from that Wikipedia article. And in particular, we extracted the first sentence as a definition for that particular entity. We wanted to see how we can look at the interplay between our definition of an entity and how it's used in context in this corpus. So similar to some of the machine comprehension work that, if you were here this morning, you saw, we also defined a plausibility closed task to test our models. So basically, the idea is that we have our context. So here's the example from before. And we're going to remove the entity from where it originally occurred and replace it by a blank. And we'd like to see if we can figure out which was the original entity that actually fit there, given access to the definitions of all of the candidate entities. And just with a little bit more detail, so the set of candidate entities was the set of entities that originally occurred in the same document. But this is something that you can play around with if you want an easier task or harder task. So here in this example, to fill in the blank, you have William Blake, which was the correct answer. But you might also have, say, Peter Aykroyd or Emanuel Swedenborg, along with their particular entity definitions. So we proposed a model to try to do a better job of this prediction task. And we proposed this double encoder model, which is a series of two neural networks, so two LSTM networks, one which encodes the context and one which encodes the definition. And then it also combines the information from the two. So on the context side, you have an LSTM which reads the context word by word, including the blank. And on the definition side, you have another LSTM which reads the definition word by word. And then once you have the encoding, you pass it into the context in the appropriate slot. And at the end, you also combine the information from both encoded representations to predict a plausibility score for whether that entity fits into that blank. And actually, we worked a little bit more to develop a hierarchical version of this model that better exploits the long-range dependencies between choices within the same document. But for reasons of time, I won't go into that here. So here are some brief subset of the results from that paper. So here's the random performance. You get around 30% correct just by randomly choosing an entity. And with the standard LSTM language model, you can get a small boost up to 40. But you really get much larger gains if you incorporate the information from the definitions, from the entity candidate definitions. So that was very nice for us. And to dig a little bit deeper into these results, we also broke down the results by the entity frequency. So on the x-axis here, we have the entities, entity types separated by their frequencies in the corpus from below 5 to more than 20. And here we have the blue bars, which are the performances for the content encoder, the standard LSTM. And the red and orange bars represent the performance of our models, which incorporate the definitions. So what you see is that the gap is between the blue bars and the other bars is much larger for the rare entities compared to the more frequent entities, where there's a gap, but it's there's still a gap, but it's much smaller. So that was nice. So it really shows that just that one short sentence, which is a definition, can help you a lot with your modeling. And furthermore, we looked a bit at some of the cases. So we found this interesting case from the data set. So you have, we heard from Audrey Bomze, who is with the Free Gaza Movement. She was in blank Cyprus. So the standard language model predicted Istanbul, which is perhaps plausible because Istanbul is a large, well-known city in the Middle East. But it's not in Cyprus, right? Whereas if you had access to the definitions and you knew that, and you knew this fact, then you can correctly predict among the candidate set and figure out that it's Larnaca. And not just that, but it turns out that Larnaca, this entity, it only appeared twice in the entire corpus, and it did not appear in the training set at all. So this was it only appeared in the test set, but this model was still able to get it correct. So that was a nice finding for us. Yeah, so those were a summary of the results from that paper. So it seems like if you want to be able to generalize your system and have more robust systems for new types of tasks and new types of data, maybe one additional source of resources that you can exploit is these external resources. So I think that in the future, it'd be nice to move beyond end-to-end training for a single task. Because for most tasks, you just don't have enough training data for these neural networks to work well on. And also, I think that it'd be nice to move more towards more modularized and reusable components. So this is these are some of the directions towards having these modularized and reusable components that my team is working on. So I talked a little bit about using external information for entities and events. And also, one of my students is working on common sense reasoning, and so we'd like to be able to incorporate say ConceptNet or other external sources of knowledge for that. And we've also done some work on reusable components for language generation, which might tie back into dialogue. So for example, one of my students looked at making predictions about sentence aggregation decisions for natural language generation. All right, so thank you very much. I'd like to thank my great group of students and collaborators at the Reasoning and Learning Lab at McGill University, and also my funding sources. Thanks.
Thank you, Jackie. I guess it's interesting to me that you are able to use the single definition that you're getting out of the Wikipedia. I guess as a, I would have expected that that might have come from the neural models if it had processed sufficient amounts of text, that kind of it would have had the background knowledge that was necessary for Larnaca. So if, for example, if Wikipedia had been already part of the data that you had used to compute the vectors for, would that have fallen out, or do you need specifically to know that that is a definition?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think it probably helps if you really specifically know that that's the definition. Because the way people write definitions and the kinds of information that's expressed in a definition are different than when you already assume you know about know something about the entity and you talk about it, assuming that is background knowledge. So I think what would be really interesting is if we can automatically predict in your training set which types of sentences containing entities are more definition-like and which are more like you assume you know something about the entity and you're just talking about the entity. And if you know that, then maybe you can just throw it all in and then just train on that. But before we have that, I think having that separation seems to really help the model. But yeah, maybe we should run an experiment where we throw all the definitions in and just try.
All right, thank you. Okay. And last up is Ian Lane from CMU.
Okay, so let me turn this on. Hello? Can anyone hear me? Okay, we're on now. So I thought I'd finish off the session today not talking about neural networks. However, that's what we're doing at the moment, so this is another neural network talk, but really focused on looking at human-to-human conversation and looking at how we can train systems based on data that already exists. So sort of the goal of my work is, can we learn to perform task-oriented dialogue by modeling human conversations? So we've got a user calling into a system. I'm looking for an Italian restaurant for dinner. There's an agent on the other end who's listening to them on the line, has access to databases and all the information they need, and they can respond in real time, whether this is via messaging or whether this is via a call center. And you have a dialogue flowing through. If you look at call centers today, typically when you make a call, it's very task-orientated. You're calling a certain number to solve a certain problem, and there's a shocking amount of data out there. So one company we are interacting with, they have over 10 million conversations every year, millions of customers, and now close to 100 million dialogues in their data over many years of business. So can we leverage this data to build more human-like or more intuitive dialogue systems in the real world? So the first I'll talk about is looking at agent models. And what we want to do here is look at data that already exists and be able to train an agent that can interact with the user, understand what they're saying, do the appropriate lookup or knowledge search as required, and then respond to the user with the goal of getting a task solved. So sort of a starting point of this is similar to what others have talked about with neural conversational models. And so using neural networks, LSTM networks, and encoder-decoder networks to take a input, a set of previous sentences, and generate an output as a set of words. And in some cases, it can work very reasonable. This is an example from the group at Google and their neural conversational model from a couple of years ago. Hello, how are you today? I'm good. What's your name? I'm Julia. When were you born? July 20th. What year were you born? 1977. Where are you from? And you can simulate dialogues in this type of manner that seem reasonable and flow quite nicely. However, sometimes they completely fail, again, because in the way that they're built. So here, the machine starts off the dialogue, hi. A human responds, hi. The machine said, could you please let me know what the operating system you're using? The human said, Linux. Okay, this is the issue with the system performance, Nazir tools. And that's something that a human would not generate, and even a well-structured dialogue system should not generate. So the systems are as good as the model structure and the data you give it, but there's inherent constraints in using a purely neural conversational model to solve tasks in the real world. So what we look at here is trainable task-oriented models for dialogue, assuming we have log data from agents that include what the agent said and what actions they took. And what we're trying to build is first an agent model where we try to understand the user's input in context, or in this case in dialogue context, take an appropriate action given the user input and the dialogue and task history. And these actions can include responding to the user, performing an API call, a database lookup, or performing some other type of action, or a combination of actions within that turn, and then updating the dialogue state for the next turn. We can even model the user as well and really try to estimate what their goal is or if they have a goal change. So we've built an agent model where we've simplified the problem a little bit. So rather than using word-based input, we delexicalize the input, and this allows our training data to cover much wider variety of input as it comes in. We use a dialogue state model, which I'll show next, via an LSTM model that estimates the dialogue state after every turn, either by the user or the agent. We try to estimate belief states that are required for API lookup, and then we can perform one of many actions. So we can issue an API call and process the results. So it's not just the call that you make, So you make a call, you get the results from it, and how should you pick which results to provide back to the user? That's part of the model actions that we need to estimate a model. We need to update our results if required, and create an appropriate response. And in a response, again, rather than generating word by word, we take templates, and there could be many thousands or millions of templates of responses that a user or an agent has had before, and use the closest matching template to respond to the user. So this is an overview of the neural network model that we're using for the agent side of our system, where we have a dialogue history and dialogue states estimated with an LSTM model. We take each user input and estimate an embedding, a semantic embedding of that using a recurrent neural network. We are then using our hidden dialogue state to estimate all of the belief states, as well as estimate what the appropriate response is and what type of API query and entity pointer to use, or what response within the knowledge base to respond back to the user. And so here, in this case, the user has asked somewhere within a dialogue, is there another restaurant that serves Italian food? From our model, we update and estimate, okay, they're looking for Italian, but they're looking for an alternative Italian. Last time it was our top-based query, we should respond with a second. And so a lot of the neural network tasks that you, or neural network models today, if you don't put in these inherent constraints about the API query and taking the response from the API query and responding to the user appropriately, here us using this knowledge base indicator and entity pointers, then you can get into crazy loops which aren't reasonable, where the same response comes again and again, or jumps around randomly. So modeling of the action task in addition to the dialogue is critical to get these systems working. So the way of training these models, really we're looking at two approaches, supervised training and reinforcement learning. We take a large amount of data that we've already applied natural language understanding and delexicalization to. We train on all of the dialogues in the human-to-human interaction. And at the moment, assuming we have turn-based back and forward, we use this to train our neural network models. We look at, as I mentioned, two approaches, supervised training, where we can really treat this as a classification task per turn. Given a dialogue history, the API calls that have been made and the responses generated by those API calls, what is the appropriate template and information to respond to the user? And the second is looking at reinforcement learning, where we optimize based on the end of dialogue reward. How well did the dialogue go? Did we get the response the user wanted? And how many turns were required to get that as an alternative way to train these models? So we've been trying on some publicly available data sets. This is the same Babby data set that Jason had been working with. And we're able to get state-of-the-art performance on this type of training data, but there are some very apparent issues. And so because we're training these models for dialogue, we're limited, but we're limited on training on static data between users. There are a couple of issues that we have to overcome. So one of it is often our system will put out something that's very reasonable, but just because it didn't match the training data, it's getting penalized, and we want to be able to improve on that. And additionally, the training data is fixed, so the user in our training data doesn't respond based on the model of the output, just based on the supervised training data that we provided. And so we want to improve on that, and we look at one method of doing this by looking at modeling both the user and the agent to improve the performance of our agent models before we deploy them. So the goal here is, if I've got a user interacting with the system and we've got lots of user data already there, we should be able to simulate new users that have different goals but interact in a similar manner. And then on the agent side, we can train a model in a similar way that we did before, and we can actually train these models jointly together to improve the performance overall. So here we introduce a user model that takes as an input a user goal. And from that goal, it's using examples from real human interaction to interact with our agent model. And by going back and forward, they are constrained by the training data so that the output that they generate is very task-specific and mimics human dialogue, but they can optimize their parameters internally to give us the best throughput or the best performance. So here we introduce a second model, our user model, again using something very similar in structure to an agent model within a dialogue system, but are using it to take in a user goal, take in dialogue history both from the user and from the agent, and generate an output as the user would that then gets passed to the agent model. And by iteratively going through dialogues, both of these systems can be optimized either independently or jointly to improve the overall performance of the system. And so here we take our user output, and this goes into the user input of the agent model, and then in the next dialogue turn, the output of the agent model gets taken as the input to the user model. So we end up training a model jointly between the two of these, where we have the appropriate encoders for both the knowledge base input as well as the user goal, and we can simulate the dialogues between our simulated user, which is trained on, again, human-to-human data, and our dialogue agent, which is interacting with us and trying to solve the task-orientated task. So we've got these up and running with different types of reinforcement learning. And what we found is with joint training of both of these models, we can much quicker and much more successfully resolve dialogues over time. So after we run something close to 20,000 dialogues between the simulated user and our neural network agent, we get a success rate of around 65%, which is much higher than a baseline just trained with supervised training, and more effective than just updating and using reinforcement learning on the agent by itself. And so we think this is a interesting area to explore more. We're still to do the human evaluations on these to validate that the output system is actually better when interacting in the real world than our baseline systems. So this is an example of the output that we get, and here with our simulated agent and simulated user. And as I mentioned, a lot of the dialogues, or most of the dialogues that we've seen through from the simulation approach, are very reasonable. And the success rate per dialogue, or the overall success rate, is about 65%. So there's still quite a number of challenges to overcome to make this work in the real world. One of it is data, and so getting logs of dialogue along with API calls and responses is required for the approaches we're using at the moment. But we found this type of approach works very well for a lot of task-oriented dialogues, especially those that contain a combination of social and task-oriented dialogue within a single task, and also include external knowledge-based lookup and action. So dealing with products or service support and call centers and messaging interfaces seems to be a good task for this type of approach. We can model both the agent and the user in conversation. At the moment, we're throwing away this information, but it's possible to bring this in as personas. So within an agent, rather than modeling all agents in general, you can model a specific agent within your call center or your messaging center. And even with users, with sufficient data from a specific user, you can start estimating personas and estimating how they will interact in dialogue by modeling them through a neural network as well. The final thing that we're starting to look into using this approach is bootstrapping new systems on the fly. So in the current system, we train on large amounts of data, we simulate more dialogue and generate models based on that. But it's possible to do this online on the fly by getting real dialogue as it comes in a call center or messaging center, seeing if the agent is responding or using the suggestions that are provided. And when they are, we learn from it. And when they're not, we can feed that back into the system immediately and get the system to bootstrap within hundreds of dialogues rather than tens of millions of dialogues. And so that's an area that we are exploring. Thank you.
Still have a few minutes. Oh, I think could you use the mic just so others can hear?
This is a very pragmatic question. Yep. I've been looking at call center dialogues.
Yes.
And found to my surprise that many agents simply cut and paste from information that they're given. And so I was looking at quite a large corpus last week, and a good percentage of it didn't actually make any sense. And so I was wondering whether you've had better luck training on those data.
Yeah, so within call centers as well, the ones that we've been looking at, if you look at the top 10% of agents compared with the longer tail of the 90%, there's a dramatic change in quality. And so even looking at human-to-human dialogue, I've seen lots of dialogue failures, but there are especially the good agents are really, really good at dialogue. And sort of the goal here is, can we take the quality of those top 10% of dialogue of agents within a call center, replicate them well enough so you get better experience even for the longer tail of the 90 or so percent. So in the training data, we end up throwing away quite a lot because the dialogue isn't of high enough quality, and we don't use that within model training. So one, we have metrics about specific agents and use that, and others we were just looking at length of call and the quality, just at the last two or three utterances, was the customer happy or not.
Other questions? Actually, I have a follow-up on that question. I haven't really looked at call center data, so I don't know what it looks like. But my impression is that sometimes these call center workers are reading from a script and going down a flow diagram. And to what extent are the models, if that's the case that's being used to generate this data, to what extent are the models learning a script that a human wrote?
So in especially for product for product support, there's a lot of structured information and structured data flow that is given, and the dialogue systems start learning that. What we found, though, is there's still, even given a dialogue flow, this is what you should be doing as an agent in the call center for this product, there are those agents who can perform it better than others. And what we do end up learning is something very similar to the data flow that is provided there. But the goal is the quality should be better than sort of a state-based or manually designed state-based dialogue system.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And thanks to all of you. I mean, I think we saw a lot of work with this ferment that's going on in the field of dialogue right now. And I think what's interesting is that not that much of it has crept into actual experiences that consumers or people at work are encountering yet. But it's coming fast. It's just shocking to me how rapidly this field is moving. And it really feels like translation, 10, 15 years ago, or maybe speech in the same era, where I think in 5-10 years, some of these experiences are going to work really well in a way that will be shocking. I mean, after many, many years, decades of effectively stasis, things are really exploding in this area. And I think we're going to see the benefits of it in the real world pretty soon. So thank you, everybody. Oh, is your question? Oh, hey, David.
Sorry, I have to take issue with that last
with
comment.
With stasis.
And in the introduction too. So it's not like dialogue, nothing's been happening for 50 years. There's SigDial, there's all of these systems, including Cortana and Siri. And there's been a lot of activity and consciousness with the public with interacting with a lot of systems in dialogue and call centers and all kinds of systems without the neural network stuff.
Right.
And I think this technology does seem very promising, but I haven't seen anything today or recently that leads me to believe that there'll be the quantum leap that we saw in speech and translation, because we're not at the state of the art yet with this technology, let alone surpassing it. So I mean, I think it's definitely worth pursuing and interesting to look at it, but I don't see we should throw away the last 50 years of the other work, and I don't see a reason at this stage to believe that we're going to surpass that anytime soon.
Right, point taken. I mean, we still have a few minutes if anybody who spoke or anybody else wants to do a mini panel discussion here. Does anybody want to respond to that? No? I think it's an interesting question. I think that's an interesting topic to discuss. All right. Well, thank you very much, everybody. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you.